Well, there are few experiences more painful than abandonment. Being deserted is, I believe, an underlying fear that probably all of us have. We've all experienced that to some degree, some trivial, others much more serious. I know there are some in this room who've been deserted by a spouse or by a parent. Those are the kinds of abandonments, I believe, that hurt the most, don't they? One of my friends in Australia has been suffering immensely for a number of years because his wife just suddenly packed the bags and left, same age as me. No warning, she just took off and left. But another kind of abandonment that the Christian might feel is the desertion of God, where we experience that God has abandoned us. He doesn't feel as close as he once did. He isn't maybe coming through in a particular area of sin in your life. He's not alleviating that mental illness. He's not coming to your aid. He's not saving the unconverted family member. You've been praying for many years. And so we ask, God, where are you? But the worst kind of abandonment is what we find and discover here in Psalm 22. You see, in Psalm 22, the king of Israel finds himself completely abandoned by God. Here we enter into the unimaginable depths of human anguish. It's a really uncomfortable read. This is a psalm of the cross. But it's not about the cross, is it? It's though we look down from the cross's perspective. But the big question we face as we come to Psalm 22 is, whose words are they? Who's this psalm about? We're told in the superscript there that Karen read for us, it's the Psalm of David. And yet there appears to be no way of mapping this experience onto David's life. There's not a single moment in David's life where he experiences this level of suffering. It's hard to know when this psalm might have been sung in Israel. Psalm 22 isn't an illness, it's an execution. It's not an illness, this is an execution. It doesn't correlate with what we know of King David. And so for that reason, I'll keep referring to the psalmist as the king. And hopefully we'll begin to see why as we go through, though I'm sure you have already put it two and two together. And really, there's just one point this morning. The psalm is actually split into two parts, verses 1 to 21 and 22 to 31. You may have noticed the change in tune as Karen read it before. It goes from minor key to major key about halfway. We move from the lows of suffering to the heights of glory. And all of our time today will be spent with the first half. And you might be thinking, oh, great. But remember, this is Good Friday. This is not Easter Sunday. And so it's good for us to feel the darkness, the heaviness, the weightiness of the cross. If you take notes, our one big point this morning is this, just one point. Fix your gaze on the forsaken king. Fix your gaze on the forsaken king. And the psalm begins with its most famous verse. It starts with a question. Verse 1, my God, why? That's a question that many people ask, isn't it? Maybe it's a question that you have. Why, God? Why all the suffering? My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from the words of my groaning? We're immediately brought into the abandonment that the king feels. This isn't a cry of a non-believer. He's not an atheist. He's not crying, God, are you there? But God, where are you? Why do you feel so distant, so far away? I look up, but I can't see you. I look around, but I can't find you. Why have you left me here in my time of greatest needs? Verse 2, oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. The king's saying, my prayers fall on deaf ears. It feels like you've shut your ear to me. You're not even there. In the day, I cry and get no response. At night, I can't sleep. I feel exhausted with grief. Why have you forsaken me? It's a jolting beginning, isn't it? This is the depth of human anguish. God seems so far away from this king. And you can almost sense the deafening silence. He experiences the agonizing distance in verse 1. So far, so far. And the deafening silence in verse 2. You do not answer. We need to recognize the terrifying predicament of the king. See, the king of Israel is meant to experience God's blessing, God's favor. He's meant to know God's presence. But God is absolutely absent. And he's not listening. The king can't rest, and God isn't there for him. And then notice verse 3. The king turns from I to you. This whole psalm is a back and forth conversation. Verse 2, I. Verse 3, yet you. Verse 6, but I. Verse 9, yet you. So the king's going back and forth to make sense of everything that's happening to him. And now in verse 3, he remembers what God is like. He casts his mind way back. Check it out. He says, yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. He says, I know my Bible. I know who you've revealed yourself to be. You're the God who's committed to your people. You're holy, not like other gods. Other gods can't save, but you do. Your people worship you, and there's a good reason for that, isn't there? Verse 4. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were rescued. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. That word trust pops out of the text, doesn't it? They trusted, they trusted, they trusted, and you delivered. The king has great confidence in the character of God. He knows God's track record. There's a reason Israel praised him. God's people constantly find themselves up the creek, don't they? And God rushes in. He swoops in and rescues. Isn't that seen so beautifully in the scriptures? I wonder if the king's thinking, reflecting on the Exodus. Remember, as God's people were in a desperate state of slavery, and they cry out to God, and God hears. And he comes down, and he saves them with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. The fathers had good reason to trust in God. Who wouldn't? He's the God who delivers. The king is saying, you rescue the men who trust you, and yet verse 6, but I am a worm. Not a man. You rescue the men who trust you, and yet you don't come to my aid. I mustn't be a man. I'm a worm. I'm this small, insignificant worm. You don't notice me in the dirt. You just walk right past. Listen to his experience in verses 6 to 8. Try and imagine this situation. I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. They say, he trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Can you see the repetition? Scorned, despised, mocked. The king is saying, they're making sport of me. They watch me suffer. And they just laugh. They just laugh. They mock. They lick their lips as I suffer. They seem to be enjoying it. They say, God? Ha, yeah, he's a real help to you right now, isn't he? Let him come and save you then. See how that works out for you. The king's enemies are taunting him, so he's wondering, what's happening, God? Why am I the contradiction to everything we held true about your faithfulness? You've been there for the fathers. Why am I the exception? Why are you leaving me to suffer like this? Yet he can't help himself, can he? He turns his attention to God again. He looks through the pages of history. He goes back through the family photo album. And he remembers that God was there with him. Verse 9. Yet you are he who took me from the womb, and you made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. See, God was there from the beginning. He was there at the bedside. God was like a tender midwife. He helped with the birth. God was there all along. And so verse 11, be not far from me. Trouble is near. There's none to help. You can feel, can't you, the heightened suspense. There's so much passion in this psalm. God, you were there then. Please help me now. The king's in critical danger. He's in a life-threatening situation. He describes his enemies in verses 12 and 13. They're terrifying enemies, strong bulls of Bashan, verse 12, ravenous lions, verse 13, dogs, verse 16. If you're like me, some of these animals don't mean much to you. You might be wondering, what's a strong bull of Bashan? Well, bulls are really fearsome animals. If you've ever watched those sort of bullfights on TV, you don't want to mess with them, do you? And Bashan was kind of the premium for breeding bulls, and so these are the strongest, the most fearsome bulls in all the world. And then we've got roaring lions. Well, it's not hard to imagine those. If you've ever been to a zoo, yeah, they look pretty cute behind the glass. But you remove that glass and you'll be running for your life. I remember working in Australia Zoo and getting the opportunity to have a tiger encounter, and I remember sitting behind a big cat. Right, and I was really, my hand was on its back, and I was really, really afraid, and I was just thinking, if he turns on me, I'll be torn from limb to limb. But there's nothing I can do. That's exactly how the king is feeling, isn't it? He feels like he's being torn apart. His enemies are vicious. And yet it goes deeper, doesn't it? The king feels like his whole self is collapsing. Look at verse 14. It's so desperate, isn't it? I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up. My tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. That's not the place you want to be. This is the physical agony that he's going through. The pain is spreading throughout his body. And he can't handle it mentally. He knows he's a dead man. He has no God to help him. And everyone hates him. Verse 16, the pack of dogs encircle around him. There's no escape. He can count all his bones. Verse 17, he's a walking skeleton. In verse 18, they strip him of his goods and dish out the spoils. This is both painful and shameful. And look at verses 19 and 20. And so he prays, God, help me. Please rescue me. Don't be far off. Deliver my soul from the sword. Save me from the dog. Save me from the lion. This is a desperate plea. The king's on the edge of certain death. He's in physical torment. He's in emotional torment. And worst of all, he's got no God to deliver him. This is the excruciating agony of Psalm 22. It's a tough read, isn't it? It would make for gruesome viewing. It's good for us to get real about Good Friday. But we must return to the question I asked at the beginning. Who exactly is this king? The superscript says it's a Psalm of David, but it's impossible to map it onto David's life. There's nowhere in Scripture where David experiences a God-forsakenness quite like what we see here. Nothing came close, did it, in David's life. Rather, David's pointing forward to the words of someone else, isn't he? He's speaking as a prophet. In other words, he's speaking way better than he knows. His words go far beyond his life, and his words reach down into the day we call Good Friday. This is Matthew 27. Isn't it? Psalm 22 is Matthew 27. Blaise Pascal once said this. He said, I would be content to rest the whole case for Christianity on the fact that so many details of Jesus' death are predicted here in this psalm, hundreds of years before it happens. I would be content to rest the whole case for Christianity on the fact that so many details of Jesus' death are predicted here in this psalm, hundreds of years before it happens. This whole psalm is played out in Jesus' life, isn't it? It starts with those words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus uttered those agonizing words in Matthew. Jesus felt the unimaginable pain of abandonment. He felt forsaken by God, left alone to die as a common criminal. See, the cross was a cursed death. Moses says, cursed is everyone who's hanged on a tree. And here, Jesus is experiencing the full weight of curse. We're also told he was mocked by his enemies. Verses 7 and 8, all who saw me mocked me. Do you remember the taunts as Jesus was on the cross? His onlookers mocked him, saying, you really think you're the Messiah? Isn't that who you claim to be? Come down then. Why is your God leaving you out here to die? Do something if you're the Messiah. In other words, you're not who you claim to be. You're an imposter. But it doesn't stop there, does it? Jesus also experiences the dryness of death. Verse 15, my strength is dried up, my tongue sticks to my jaws. What did Jesus exclaim from the cross? I thirst. On the cross, the life-giving water itself is being quenched. Jesus dries up as he's hanging out to die in the blazing heat of Israel. And then in verse 16, we see the cross with astonishing clarity, don't we? We read, they have pierced my hands and my feet. David's looking ahead to crucifixion. See, the Roman cross was the worst form of ancient torture. The word excruciating comes from the Latin word excruciatus, which means out of the cross. The very word for agony is borrowed from crucifixion. And yet it doesn't stop there. The soldiers make a profit, don't they, from Jesus' torture. They strip Jesus from all self-respect and dignity. We don't see Jesus hanging on a cross with a loincloth, as in works of art. That's not how it is. He's hanging here totally naked, exposed to the crowds. Verse 18, they divide my garments among them. For my clothing they cast lots. We read that in Matthew's Gospel, didn't we? Jesus is exposed to the crowd, totally naked. We get a sense of how Jesus feels in verse 6. I am a worm, not a man. I don't know if you keep up with pop culture, it's not worth your time. But you may have heard about the incident with Will Smith, how he slapped Chris Rock or punched Chris Rock at the Oscars. It was completely shameful. You can see Will Smith's shame in the interviews as tears run down his face. He feels utterly ashamed. He's let his family down, himself down, and everyone down. But that shame is nothing compared to this, is it? Nothing compared to this. Jesus is hanging naked on a Roman cross, and as the soldiers rip his clothes, they make Jesus an embarrassing spectacle. And Jesus is looking down from the cross, isn't he, in this psalm. He's seeing human beings behaving like animals, like dogs and bulls and lions. They're thirsty for his blood. He's dying a shamed, cursed death. And he's being mocked for it. But actually, this is why Jesus came to earth. He came to save people like that are crucifying him. He came to save people like that. People like us. It's a solemn day, isn't it? It's a day to tremble. It's a day of anguish. I don't know if you know that song, were you there when they crucified my Lord? Sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, tremble. That's how we're supposed to feel as we see the giver of life slain by sinful men, hated, mocked, stripped, killed, forsaken by God. Easter isn't about chocolate eggs. It's about a Roman cross. And yet most remarkably of all, the Gospel tells us that Jesus came for this very purpose. The events of Psalm 22 is a planned event. Jesus didn't make a mistake. He didn't go to the cross against his will. The cross is not a tragic accident. He set his face, didn't he, like flint towards Jerusalem. He planned from all eternity to die on Good Friday. This was always in the Saviour's plans. The cross was not an accident. Jesus said, "No one takes my life from me. I lay it down on my own authority." But that doesn't mean it was easy. See, the cross is so horrific that everything in Jesus shrunk from it. Now, how did Jesus pray in the garden? Do you remember? He prayed agonizingly on his knees, dropping sweats of blood. He was in deep anguish. He knew what he was about to face, and he prayed, "Father, if you're willing, remove, take it away from me. Yet your will be done." Jesus was in emotional anguish over the cross. He dreaded the cursed death he was about to face. John Stott once told the story of Socrates in his prison cell in Athens when he was on death row. And there in Athens, Socrates famously took the cup of hemlock, the poison, and he drank it without fear, without expression or trembling. He raised the cup to his lips and quietly and cheerfully drank it. He even rebuked his disciples. They were in horror, but he rebuked them, telling them to be brave. And so, says John Stott, was Socrates braver than Jesus? Or were their cups filled with different poisons? Were their cups filled with different poisons? You see, Jesus drank the cup of anguish. My God, why have you forsaken me? We're not just talking about physical pain there. We're talking about the cup of God's forsakenness, the cup of God's wrath against sin. That's why Jesus hangs here to die. That's why he's crying out from the cross. That's what Good Friday is all about. Isn't it? Jesus, the King of glory, drinking the cup of God's righteous anger, his holy hatred of sin, in order to set sinners like you and me free. See, Jesus looks down from the cross. He sees nothing but beasts and animals, bulls and dogs and lions. And yet he allows them, those very same people, to nail him to a cross that they might be brought into his family. This is the day of salvation. The day of salvation. The day where Jesus pays for your sin, personally your sin and mine. You see, we should be on that cross, shouldn't we? Psalm 22 should be about us. We deserve the curse of God's judgment. We are the ones to break God's law. But Jesus goes there in our place. He lays down his life that we might have everlasting life. And so let me ask you this morning, have you put your faith in Jesus? Have you trusted in his death for you? Jesus went to the cross to save his people from their sins. He came to take the curse in order to give us the blessing. Have you come to Jesus yet? And if not, why don't you come to him? Trust that Jesus died on that cross and that he took away your sin. That's what the cross is all about. It's about forgiveness in the blood of Christ. Seeing God in Christ, God washes away our sins. Jesus takes all of this horrible punishment here in the psalm so that we don't have to. And obviously, if you're a Christian, never lose the scandal of grace. Never lose the scandal of grace. Never become bored of the cross. Don't try and outgrow it. It's the most life-changing, joy-filled, and yet solemn event in all the world. God the Son, dead on a cross. Imagine that. That his enemies might go free. Amazing love, how can it be that thou, my God, should die for me? Well, the first half of the psalm is sung in minor key, but then there's an ecstatic change of tune as we hit verse 21. The whole psalm actually turns on verse 21. It's the big turning point. I'll read it in the order that in the Hebrew. because it ends with the main turning point. So it says, save me from the mouth of the lion. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen. You have answered me. There it is. You have answered me. This verse points us forward to the empty tomb, the rising of the Son of God. I'm not going to go into these verses, of course. We need to wait until Sunday for the resurrection, but if you want in your spare time tomorrow to read this part of the psalm, that'll be a really good way to prepare your heart for Sunday, though I'm preaching Psalm 16 on Sunday, not Psalm 22, but it will prepare your hearts. I'd encourage you to do that. In Psalm 22, well, it ends with triumph. It ends with triumph. Do you see that there in verse 31? They shall proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn and say that he has done it. He has done it. Doesn't that sound like the words Jesus exclaimed on the cross? It is finished. It's accomplished. There's nothing left to pay. The work the Father has given me to do, it is finished. And this psalm's being fulfilled today, isn't it? I'm doing it right now, proclaiming his righteousness. I'm telling you about the finished work of Christ. He has done it. It's not due, it's done. Religion won't save you. Jesus will save you. Something amazing was accomplished when Jesus died. It was a masterpiece of love and redemption. But what was finished? Well, through his death, Jesus reveals the ugliness of sin, doesn't he? Our sin, the ugliness of it. Through his death, Jesus reveals the costliness of grace. On the cross, Jesus satisfies God's wrath. That is what's finished. He displays God's mercy. He shows us what love looks like. This is love. And so why did Jesus cry out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Do you see why God deserted Jesus on the cross? Why verse 1 had to happen? He did it for love. He did it for you. You see, Jesus' love for you kept him on that cross. And now it is finished. There's nothing left to pay. It is finished. The way is open. It is finished. Atonement is made. It is finished. Salvation is here. It is finished. God has become ours through Christ.